Tally-ho, Brendan.
Good day, Alan.
The Not A Thing podcast is going for episode 210. I don't know. Numerologically, that's just fun because it has a zero in it, I think. But it's at the
end. Zeros are easier somehow.
Yeah. we're still, what, six away from the Stargate SG-1 number?
From beating Stargate SG-1. Yes. I think they had 215.
So. Well, we'll be there soon. If you'd like to join us on our march towards towards the Stargate there, please let us know.
We have like six chevrons locked right now.
Yes.
You're welcome, Stargate nerds.
Stargate's a thing, for sure. If you would like to be on the show with us, let us know. Tweet at us, Facebook us, say hi in the hallways, whatever you need to do to track us down. And it'll be fun. We'll have you on as a guest. It'll be a thing. In the meantime, we'll jump into this week's kind of topics and stories. We're starting in jolly old England, where the police in England have they've decided to sidestep the whole issue that happened in the U.S. about trying to compel Apple to unlock a phone or otherwise put a backdoor into the iPhone in order to get data out of it for investigative purposes or whatever. In England, they just decided that the police will get a warrant or whatever they call them in England to grab the phone out of the suspect's hands while it's unlocked. And then they've already done this in a case. I think it was for it was to bust a ring of credit card thieves, I think, or something like that. And the way they did it was they identified someone with information supposedly on their phone, and they essentially mugged him. You know, they beat him up and grabbed his phone, and while he was restrained and the phone was unlocked, because they surveilled him to see him like unlock the phone to check Facebook or make a phone call or whatever, they grabbed the phone from him, connected it to a computer to dump all of the data, and then an officer kept the phone awake so it wouldn't lock by just swiping through screens while the data dump was completed. They eventually got enough data to bring a case, and I believe they even convicted the suspect of that case. And so it really sets a precedent about, you know, what law enforcement can do. In the States, it's still I would think that still counts as unreasonable search and seizure. That's one of those nice things about the United States is we have a constitution, and England does not. So suck it, England. But really, that you know, the data privacy and sovereignty, and when you can be compelled to unlock your phone and with what, you know, if you can, if they can compel. I believe in the United States, it's gray if you can, you can tell a person to use their thumbprint, but you can't compel them to give you their code, or vice versa. This is one of those things that we should probably figure out before we're arrested and forced to do that.
Stay away from my phone.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they went to a tried and true tactic of the playground. Like, you get held down by the bully while the other person goes through your stuff.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Good job, England.
Not a thing. Big Brother is stealing your phones.
And this was not for like a violent criminal. This is a guy committing fraud.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know.
Making fake credit cards.
Okay. So yeah, clearly, an interesting tactic. You really can't guard against it because if you want to use your phone, it generally has to be unlocked. There are some actions you can take with the phone while it's locked, but it pretty much makes it useless if you want to do anything with the phone. They're all reaction kinds of things. Like if a phone call comes in, you can answer it without unlocking. But If you want to make a call, you have to unlock it. It's
well, if Battlefield 1 has taught me anything so far, it's that pigeon is the securest form of transportation of information. There's a mission where you're in a tank and you send out a carrier pigeon, and then you get to control that pigeon back to the line so they can call in an artillery strike.
Wow.
And it was majestic and relaxing. It was great. That game is gorgeous.
That's awesome. Kind of, we'll come back to games in a moment, but actually sticking around in the credit card and fraud theme, there was some data put out this last week about thieves supposedly being able to guess credit cards in under minutes time. So, you know, when you purchase something online, or in person, you know, they swipe your credit card, and then there's some amount of kind of data checking to say that this is a valid card and you are the person that is supposed to have this card. And so in person, that used to be you swipe the card and then you had to sign something, and then the card number plus signature was like, that's you paying for this thing. But because of credit card fraud and stuff like that, all sorts of features had to be built into the card, like the knowing the expiration date or having that, you know, weird number on the back. Or in person, now a lot of places use the smart card chip, you know, that had been in process in Europe for a long time, but it's starting to kind of happen in the US a lot more. I find that it's a lot slower, but if it means that someone's not stealing my card, generally that's good. But what happens online is that there aren't chip readers online, so you're still only limited to the card number, the expiration date, the number on the back, and sometimes the billing zip code is asked when I've purchased things. And it turns out most, if not all, of that information can be guessed. But the problem is, if you try and guess it on a single site, usually it'll create a fraud alert or something will trigger that you're trying to, you know, guess a credit card piece of information or whatever. What folks have done is thieves have figured out that there's kind of a limited number of tries you can have. Let's say it's 3 before it causes a lock. So you can do 2. Well, what they do is they go and find websites that are, you know, just all over, and then they try the card twice at all of those places, and eventually they will get all of the information that's necessary. And the reason they can do this is because there's no centralized checking of who's testing all of these things. Anyone in you know, IT security or networking has seen this. This is where like an attacker, you know, tries to guess the password, and if it comes in from the same IP address 3 times, we can block it. But what folks have figured out how to do is, why don't I just make the attacks come from different computers, and then you can't tell that it's me trying to break in because they come from different computers. And this is another one of those things where the internet is bad, unfortunately. The system is set up without kind of centralized checks and balances, and then also it's really set for the consumer's convenience to allow, you know, multiple tries and things like that. The unfortunate thing about that is that multiple tries means multiple possibilities for thieves to break into it. What we really need is kind of an overhaul of how credit cards work, or payments in general. Money changing hands, I think, works as a system in person, but working online, I think, could be better. There are probably better ways to deal with that. Whether those will be implemented or not is something that I know we'll follow on this show. We talked about Bitcoin in maybe one of the first, if not the first, episode of the Not a Thing podcast.
The first episode was all Batman.
Maybe it was the second one. It was whichever one. It was whichever one we talked about the Silk Road on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Long time fans of the Not a Thing podcast will, I'm sure, call in to correct us. Or rather,
did we outlasted the Silk Road, didn't we?
I think we did. I'm pretty sure we did.
Suck it, Dark Web. Please don't DDoS
me. But different payment methods or having some kind of, you know, digital intermediary for cash that isn't related to a credit card system is something that I know we've talked about on the show and would be, you know, really interesting. Having something like digital cash that can be still anonymous but still, like, verifiable would be really interesting. So we'll keep an eye out for things of that nature. But in a world without cash, it seems like that's what Amazon is searching for, at least in their brick-and-mortar stores, which they've announced this week. Amazon has kind of toyed with having brick-and-mortar stores. They even toyed with having a physical bookstore, which I think is hilarious because that's pretty much what they put out of business by having Amazon.com in the first place. But they are advocating a set of grocery stores, the first of which is going to be in Seattle, opening sometime next year, I think. But it's going to be called Amazon Go, and the setup is that you can walk into the store, sign in with your phone or some other device that is related to your credit card payment system or your Amazon account, actually. And then you just walk around the store and pick stuff up off the shelves. And then when you want to leave, you leave. And it combines some, like, sensors and cameras and all sorts of stuff to figure out what you pick up to buy, and if you put it back, it deducts that from your shopping cart, your virtual cart, and then when you walk out, it tags all of those things, and then will you know, flag it in your account, and the purchase will be done without you working with a cashier or getting in line or anything else. So it seems like a very interesting thing. It brings up a lot of stuff that we can talk about. So I'm not sure where we start. Where do we start, Brendan?
That's cool.
It is.
And my first question is, are they going to replace cashiers with security guards?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I don't know if they even need security guards, because once you're in, it seems like they must have, like, a significant amount of tracking to tell what you're doing. So I'm guessing a lot of cameras and kind of figuring out who you are. So either facial recognition or recognition of what you're wearing.
But what if you don't have an Amazon account? What if you just walk in?
Oh, well, they would probably have to gate you somehow on the way in. That would probably be more tricky. I mean, they're going to have people in the stores still. It seems like stocking the shelves is still going to be a thing. They're in the video, they have a picture of, or a video of someone, you know, seemingly at a deli counter. So I would think that there would still be people in the stores. I think the first kind of press around it was like, oh, they're making all the cashiers not have jobs. You know, this is the, you know, they're taking jobs away. And I think, you know, there are going to be other jobs that are there, but I don't think that this is Amazon's goal, is to have a cashierless kind of system. I think their goal is to kind of finally figure out how people buy things in the real world, because currently Amazon knows probably quite a bit about how people buy things online, seeing as they sell all of that kind of stuff. But this is.
I have bought a lot of stuff from them lately.
This is.
Must be confusing the hell out of them.
Yeah, tis the season, right? I mean, but buying your everyday things, not the things that you want as gifts or the things you want, on whims for yourself. Just buying your everyday things, like you know, supplies for food or water or whatever else you might need for the week, groceries, regular things like that, toilet paper, all of that stuff. Building that profile, this is what allows them to do that. And by making it kind of neat and frictionless, it's super attractive. Everyone's going to want to try to do that. And it will just become, you know, another data point for them about what you buy and what you like to buy and how they can data mine that for making you buy other things or being the best source for them to buy or to sell you other things. It really is, though, pretty impressive. The video shows someone walking through the store, picking something up, putting it back, and then picking it up again. And if, you know, it does look like they're going to have some combination of things. It'll probably be similar to the mini bars in hotels. If you ever open up the little fridge and pick up, the snack or whatever, it probably can tell, if you've picked it up or not. So there's going to be stuff like that. I think it'll be interesting if it, because I've seen people abandon, and I've done it too, and they've just decided to abandon their whole cart and then leave because something else came up, or, you know, and then all of that just sits in a cart in the store. It would have to know if you put something away in a bag. I mean, the video is really interesting. It shows people putting the, like, They walk in and they're essentially just filling their own grocery bags and leaving. That's fascinating to me for them to be able to tell, like, where you put it. Like, how can you tell if I put it in this cart, which I then left, or if I left it in my coat as I'm, you know, walking out? I guess it would have to do some kind of like RFID tags or other sensors to tell. Otherwise, there must be just cameras everywhere, just at every angle. And that's probably true, too. That's so creepy. I don't...
buy your food in a surveillance state.
Yeah, yeah. It is really interesting to see... this will be really, really interesting to see what and how well it works. It does sound super attractive. I mean, the video makes it sound like, oh, they'll just be able, you'll just be able to walk in and then, you know, walk out. I think what will also be interesting is if they do use it, because they are using it to build that profile of what you buy, it'll be interesting to see if you if you're regular enough, like you come in and it'll be like, oh, look, here's all the stuff that you buy every week. Just ready for you to take home. You don't even have to walk in for that kind of stuff. It could just be delivered to you. We're generating the shut-in world of what was that movie with Bruce Willis?
Surrogates?
Yes.
Yeah, I never saw that.
Yeah, me neither.
Didn't see it, rather not live it.
Well, if you ever get fed up with the system kind of tracking you and stealing your phone and otherwise doing stuff like that, you can now go to Dallas and give $5 to a woman who has set up what she terms the anger room, and you get a selection of you know, like bashing implements. They have like baseball bats and, you know, cricket paddles and hockey sticks and all that kind of stuff. And what she's done is she's gone around and collected stuff that was junk, usually left on the curb for pickup. It can be electronic things, it could be furniture, and she sets it up in a room. And then you pay $5 for some amount of time to just walk in there and beat the shit out of it. I think
it's living in the office space.
Yes, exactly. You're kind of living the dream there. I think it's really funny that, you know, people have that much kind of pent up anger. But it's true. There's a lot of things that you can be angry about. We talked about many of them a couple weeks ago.
It seems like a healthy way to deal with it.
I think it's sort of healthy. I mean, I think releasing the anger in a way that does not harm yourself or others is a good thing. You know, so in from that respect, I think it's good. I think though that it does speak to, you know, like where is this kind of anger coming from, and is there any way to actually combat it from coming up?
Kill yourself.
Not a thing, by the way.
Life causes. Yeah, no, don't do that. Life is makes you angry.
Yeah.
I would have much rather had this room available than when I broke my hand last year. That was real dumb.
Yeah, I would say, as someone that has actually like tried to hit things with, especially with a hammer, or like a sledgehammer or anything that's long, your hand-eye coordination only goes so far. You gotta, you know, be able to hit a target that's potentially tiny. And that's harder than people think. I know this from trying to smash hard drives with a sledgehammer. it's easy to miss, and you feel really silly when you end up pulverizing a whole bunch of like dirt and rocks because you're missing your target.
It just makes you angrier,
right? And it's real easy, especially because if you're using, you know, your hands or your feet or anything, you know, to smash stuff, it's real easy to hurt yourself doing that. So I recommend that you know, wear hardy shoes and gloves. but I do think it's an interesting use of kind of discarded goods.
Yeah.
And I do think that you know, there's something to be said about, you know, releasing aggression, especially physically. You can only do so much killing of demons in Doom, you know, it doesn't really get rid of all of your aggression.
I like that. So there's now rage rooms, not just in Dallas, but all over the world.
Mm.
And in Toronto for $19.99, you get 45 minutes of smashing stuff. You bring your own music and they give you a video download of what you did.
So you can have your, like, you know, destruction soundtrack.
Yeah.
I like this. This is.
I kind of want to go do that, but just bring the happiest music.
This is how they flag you for bad things, by the way.
and then smash like angry music.
Yeah.
While I'm listening to happy music. That'd be art.
That would be pretty cool. It certainly it'll probably do more, you know, for your well-being than hopefully we'll see than 800 scientists will. So 800 scientists, 800 plus scientists and leaders in energy and research put together an open letter to President-elect Donald Trump. Oh God,
it's still hard to say.
I want to throw up a little. Anyway, it went up on Scientific American's website, and it's an open letter kind of urging him to take, I think it's 6 actions, you know, specifically around climate change, which is to say, in short, to acknowledge that it's a thing and not kill the earth while you're at it. We'll see. I think the obviously the intention is great, and the amount of support in it is amazing. Like it was funny when I found it, and I looked at the page and I started scrolling, and I realized the 6 kinds of things are maybe like, you know, like the tiniest, like 1% of the page, and the whole rest of the page, if you scroll and scroll and scroll, are all the signatories, most of whom are, you know, PhDs, And it's just, from what I understand, it's just, this is just the Americans that are signing this. So this is not even, you know, open to, you know, any international scientists and folks that would like to get connected to it. So it's kind of phenomenal. It'd be interesting to see if any of that gets taken to heart. Maybe if, you see, what I think we need to do is, like, build a business that, you know, will correct climate change and then somehow sell stock in it to Donald Trump. And then maybe he will be for fixing climate change. I mean, maybe that's the way we have to motivate him rather than, you know, 800 plus signatures on a website. But we'll see.
Give him stock options.
Exactly. I think it would. There are ways to do it. I mean, it could usher in a new era of greenwashing. I remember that happened, that was happening a few years ago. You would see buildings with LEED certification and all sorts of products. All of a sudden, had you know, chemical-free versions or things like that, or. And a lot of that, you know, is kind of marketing and not actually doing things, but some of it is real. And it would hopefully, I think there's a lot of business opportunity in kind of fighting climate change. And I'm really surprised that that angle isn't used more as a motivator, especially, you know, given, you know, the people involved. I do like how the language, I think for the first and, you know, the prime one is like, let's make America a leader in dealing with climate change. And I like the sentiment of that. The hard part about it is getting people to believe that climate change is a thing, even though I don't understand how you can not think it is. But... That's a whole other thing. So hopefully, that has kind of some effect on the incoming administration, or at least if not, you know, something is done to make the climate a priority. I think there was a stat that I read just this last week that like an amount of ice that is the size of India has melted in the last some amount of time.
It's real bad.
It's not awesome. I think the climate accords that were put together in France, you know, are a thing and should be treated as such. There was note that I think France and England are going to be moving away from coal, and their goal is to be completely off of coal production by 2025. And then, you know, meanwhile, you know, we're still claiming that lots of jobs are going to be lost, and they probably will be, but, you know, or the planet is lost. I don't know. There's a trade-off in there somewhere.
Why not just switch? Just make more jobs in that other kind of energy production.
Your logic makes too much sense, sir. Well, we're going to escape the real world for a little bit and go into the World of Warcraft a little bit. So World of Warcraft is, you know, the many times over still selling game from Blizzard. I forget how long it's been around. It's been a long time, but their whole thing is that they're played on servers. So you're at home playing your game and you have to connect to a server to play. And over time, Blizzard has kind of expanded the game world and added a bunch of features and changed things. And there has been a large group of people that actually don't like all of the changes that Blizzard's made, and they like the experience of playing World of Warcraft in its original release form, you know, minus the bugs, I would hope. But What that means is you can't play those versions of World of Warcraft, because even though you've bought the game or you're paying the subscription for the game, you can only play on the servers that are currently deployed, which are very, very different, vastly different from the original kind of games. So what some folks have figured out is they've reverse engineered enough of the server components that they are they've released legacy servers. So they're servers that were built around the original flavors of the game, and their idea was that people would want to play this even when Blizzard eventually, because they will probably eventually discontinue the game, and they don't want all of that gameplay to be unavailable. And so Blizzard, I think 3 or 4 months ago, gave them a cease and desist order because it was infringing on copyright. And then there was a meeting between those folks and Blizzard, and they said, and Blizzard was like, "That's a good idea." They said that they would try to have those available. Meanwhile, the Elysium Group, which is the group that was creating the legacy servers, have decided, we're not going to wait until Blizzard makes their official announcement about what to do. They're just going to open source the whole thing and release all of the code, and they're available to play again. So now it's, when you put something out on the internet, it's pretty much out there forever. And this is probably going to be a mess to disentangle for Blizzard to see. But I think it's interesting from the point of view of, for a lot of these kind of hosted services or subscription gameplay kinds of things, once those servers go away because it's not worth it to run them anymore, that game is gone. That game disappears and it's just never played again. And this is an instance where there's at least some hope that that game might have some kind of ability to be played. Because I was just at a, an event where they had like lots of retro games and lots of, there's a lot of play and nostalgia gaming, like the mini Nintendo Entertainment System that seems to be sold out everywhere, that has something like 30 Nintendo games, which, by the way, it has Super C, but not the original Contra, which I think is broken, but that's just me, just saying. Anyway, there's a lot of nostalgia in playing games that we used to play, because it used to be that you could buy a game and play it, but with everything being hosted or everything being having an online component, that just won't be the case. Like, you may not even be able to play an online game next year if that company decides to go under and then the servers stop running. So having some way to kind of continue that experience, I think, has some validity. So we'll see. I'm not going to get back into WoW, as far as I can tell. I did that for, it was almost 2 years, and now I'm, I was able to, kick the habit.
I downloaded a demo once and played for like an hour. And got bored, so I quit.
Yeah, it's probably for the best. It's not. There is. I think there is a fun aspect to it, but I think the actual gameplay is not that fun. It was more interesting from a like interacting with people kind of point of view. And if no one's playing on the servers, whether they're hosted by Blizzard or whatever, it won't be fun anyway. So you really need the community for a game like that to work. Kind of sticking with that vein of companies shutting things down and then losing functionality, some news was announced this week that Fitbit is buying the Pebble watch. So the Pebble was one of the first smartwatches. It was kickstarted, and it was like at the time one of the, if not the highest, highest funded Kickstarters like in history. It's like one of the top five still, if I'm remembering correctly. And it's a watch that you pair with your phone, and then it had all of the features. You know, this was before Apple had their watch, before Samsung, you know, and the other Android manufacturers had their watches. And so it was, you know, pretty revolutionary. And they kickstarted it to great success twice, I believe. They decided to sell to Fitbit. And Fitbit, instead of picking the project up and kind of continuing it, they've decided to just take all the intellectual property and then shutter the company. So that means that there won't be any further updates to the Pebble platform. There won't be any more hardware that's coming out for it. Replacement hardware is probably going to be a lot harder to get. And furthermore, there's kind of a thinly veiled threat in the announcement on Pebble's webpage that says functionality of Pebble watches may decrease over time, essentially saying that Fitbit will probably lock out features as they incorporate those features into Fitbit devices kind of over time. And that sucks. It shows that, you know, you can buy something and it can be changed and not yours anymore or not functional anymore. You know, something as simple as the Pebble watch, which, as far as I know, had no functionality on its own other than telling time. You need the watch in range for it to do any of the features like notification or any of the measuring that it would do. You have to have the app paired that was there. Otherwise, it's really just a digital watch. And it seems, it is an absolute bummer for anyone that bought that and is now essentially screwed out of their device. So, keep an eye out for things like this. I feel like this kind of thing is going to happen more and more as devices become smarter and more interconnected to things. The dependencies on them are going to be really interesting, especially as companies merge and you know, things like this go away. So, you know, pour one out on the curb for Pebble if you bought one.
Nope.
Well, in that case, instead of the curb, let's go to the gutter. there's a stat and something like sewage treatment plants process something like 34, it's some ungodly number, like billion gallons of yuck every day. I hope it's not that many, but a lot. There's a lot of sewage because there's a lot of people making a lot of something. So there have been moves towards making that sewage usable again. There's still hydrocarbons in it and whatever else. So in theory, it could be processed into fuel. A lot of those systems, you know, take a long time, or they require a lot of kind of prep before the thing can work. Like you have to dry the sewage out, or you know, evaporate all the water off, or something horrible like that. So scientists have figured out a method called hydrothermal liquefaction, which just sounds awesome. Great. And it creates they call it bio crude. It's like an unprocessed oil that has, you know, the qualities of fuel, and that'll happen within minutes. And it's something like each person can generate 2 to 3 gallons of like gasoline essentially per year. If all of that could be refined and pulled together, and that number will probably, or that efficiency will probably go up over time if it's something that can be looked at. But it really speaks to like a way to make fuel, have people generate their own energy, at least in some kind of small degree, rather than just generating waste, which, you know, has to be processed or is more likely just dumped into the ocean and doing bad things to all sorts of creatures and the earth. I think it's a thing. Hopefully it can be something that is kind of sequestered away. I don't necessarily need my poo to be hydrothermally liquefacted, you know, in my house, but
maybe not at home, but it's good use.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to do everything we can.
Right.
Get
right.
Trump to invest in this.
Moving on from that, our last story this week, is about scientists studying how birds fly, and you'd think that was all figured out, but it's not. There's still a lot of nuance in things, and one of the things that they wanted to study was that as birds' wings flap, there's obviously a lift component from the flapping, but then they wanted to study vortices, so you know, multiple vortex things. Vortexes? Vortices? Whatever.
Vortices, that's the word.
plural word. Anyway, there's a vortex that's created at the tip of the wing as it slices through the air. And there's a lot of theory about how that works. You can kind of see it in fixed wings as they fly through the air. You'll see kind of a vortex as the wind kind of rolls off the edge of the wing. But they wanted to know if that happened with birds as well. And so the way that they were going to do this was they were going to fill a room with kind of a light smoke, shine a laser in a sheet kind of through the smoke to illuminate it, and then have a bird fly through it, and then they would watch the smoke kind of do whatever it does and measure it, you know, based on the reflectivity of the lasers, and film it in slow motion and all sorts of stuff. And it makes perfect sense, except lasers are bad for eyes in general. There's a warning on almost every laser you can buy that says, it can destroy your vision. Don't look directly into the laser with your remaining good eye. In order to protect the bird, they 3D printed little goggles for the bird to wear with red lenses that filter out the laser light, and it's great. We're linking the story in the show notes, so be sure to check those. As we do every week, we always talk about all the stories we talk about in the show notes for each one. So take a look at those. But there's a picture of the bird wearing the goggles, and you'll feel better about the world after seeing that.
It will make your day better.
Maybe you don't have to go to the rage room today. Maybe.
Give the electronics a break.
Well, hopefully you're not going to the rage room immediately after this episode. We still have some episodes to go for, like I said, on our march to 216. But then also we're getting close to the end of the year. Thank God. And every year we always do our Backtune in Review show. So look forward to that. If you'd like to be part of shows or have thoughts about things or things to share, tweet at us, Facebook us, go to the notathingpodcast.com website, leave some comments in the article for the show, and check out the show notes while you're there, and generally hang out with us towards the end of the year. We'd love to have you on the show or otherwise kind of chat about the Not a Thing podcast. I've chatted with a couple people in real life in the last couple, you know, days about the show, and thanks for listening. Thanks for continuing to listen, and hopefully we can get you on the show and we can chat about stuff live. It'll be fun. And Brendan, I think that's pretty good. I will talk to you next week.
Till next time, Alan.